times. Here's a fun fact from Alexandra Horowitz's new book, Inside of a Dog. Human beings have 6 million receptor sites in their noses, while a beagle has 300 million. That tells you a lot about how differently the world appears to a dog. Horowitz calls dogs creatures of the nose because of their highly developed sense of smell. She's a psychologist who's been studying cognition in animals, especially in dogs. Her work is based on recent research and her own observations of dogs in action. She's also a dog person, as am I. Her book is subtitled What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. Alexandra Horowitz is an assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College at Columbia University and joins us this morning from New York, where she lives. And Alexandra Horowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Congratulations on your book.
Thanks, and thanks for having me, Marty.
And your new baby.
Indeed, yes,
a month old. Congratulations on that as well. Well, let's put some basic information on the table here. What is a dog, genetically speaking?
A dog is a member of the carnivore family and the canid subfamily, and this includes all sorts of other dog-like creatures. Wolves, coyotes are familiar members of this family, and they are the domesticated and only domesticated version of the canid family.
And a quick description of the evolution from wolf to dog, how did that happen?
Yeah, what probably has happened, and we don't know for certain, is that an ancestor of both wolves and dogs, some probably wolf-like creature, started hanging around ancient human civilization some tens of thousands of years ago. And these animals were tolerated by the humans. Some were maybe taken in and bred or even eaten by the humans, and eventually selectively bred by ancient forebears of our species for the types of traits that we seem to prefer in dogs today.
Which is hanging around, I guess. Also protection.
Yes, protection. There might have been some mutual hunting at the time. They might have been an assist in hunting. For instance, they are very acute at seeing movement in a bush, much more acute than we are. And then for maybe other things which are familiar to us in our bonding with other humans, like looking at us in our faces, for instance.
In fact, you say that they have very high levels of, maybe this is a human word, but social cognition. I mean, if you live with a dog, you see that.
Yeah, exactly. What's become interesting about studying dogs from a research and academic perspective is that they're much better at tests of what we call social cognition, in other words, figuring out what other animate creatures are doing and predicting their behavior, than even other primates, even chimpanzees.
What does that tell you?
That indicates that they're well-domesticated, well-suited to humans, that some part of our, what we consider to be a human ability of cooperation and understanding of each other, is not just genetically encoded, so not necessarily in other primates, but also is inculcated, is part of our culture.
You write about something called Umwelt, and I want you to describe that to our listeners. What does that mean?
Yeah, this is a word from early 20th century German biologist who introduced the notion of the Umwelt to start to focus the conversation about animals onto what they perceived in the world. Their Umwelt really means worldview or self-world. And his idea, and the one that I want to pick up again and revitalize again, is that if we want to understand an animal, we can't just look at them through human spectacles, as it were. We have to understand what they can know, what their sensory equipment is, and what things are salient or important in the environment for them. And then we begin to understand what it might be like to be that creature.
How do you do that? And I know that's sort of what your book is about, and that's certainly what this research is about. But how do you get into the so-called mind of a dog, the head of a dog?
Well, I think you do start by trying to understand exactly what it is that the animal can perceive. So in a dog's case, that means running through somewhat familiar sensory apparatuses, right? The ears, the nose, the mouth, the eyes, and seeing how they are different or similar to our ears, nose, mouth, and eyes, and what that means about their experience walking down the street. And it also means looking at some of these tests of cognition that psychology has introduced and we've applied to dogs to see what they can understand and know about the world. And then we start to see, get a picture of their abilities and the ways they're much more profound than our abilities and ways in which they don't match up to our abilities.
I mentioned by talking about beagles having 300 million receptor sites in their noses, giving an obvious indication about the ability of dogs to have an acute sense of smell. But help us understand even the kind of breathing that dogs do that helps them sort of smell in this world that we share with them, but we just have no idea about.
Right. I think we all know that dogs smell well, right? But I was surprised even at finding how acute their sense of smell was and how it must change their whole experience. And the example of inhaling and exhaling is a nice way to see how it diverges from our inhale and exhaling. We breathe in and then through one nostril and breathe out through the same nostril, and any smell that goes in has to be kind of exhaled before we can get another whiff of it. But dogs actually breathe differently, inhale differently, so that as they have inhaled air, they push exhale out the slits in the side of their noses, and this exhale allows for the inhale of more air that might contain odors, and also creates a little wind, a little vortex, which encourages more air to be inhaled. So they continuously see through their sniffing, whereas we sniff in little bursts.
And it, I guess, explains the fact that, you know, that there are sniffer dogs that can, you know, sniff out bombs and things like that. Dogs that have been able to smell disease among their owners?
Yeah, there are increasing numbers of studies trying to figure out exactly what it is that dogs can smell in disease. But there have been a few studies showing, indicating that dogs can trained dogs, this doesn't mean anybody's dog, but a trained dog can distinguish a cancerous tissue from a non-cancerous tissue, or can anticipate an epileptic seizure in their owners before it happens and get their owners to someplace safe to sit down. So they'll be able to detect something, they're able to smell something about the seizure or about the disease, and then locate it for us.
Wow. You also say, and this is, I think, quoting from your book, that as far as a dog is concerned, humans stink.
Yeah, we are a great source of smell. And also in places, as you know, from having a dog or being greeted by other dogs,
sure,
that we always don't always want to call attention to. But it is not at all surprising to me that dogs approach us in particular parts of our body, because those are the smelliest and must contain a lot of information about us.
Well, one can only imagine what they know about us, considering what they have access to. You also describe that, and I think a lot of people do send their dogs to get, you know, groomed and bathed and things like that, is that the dogs, I mean, for obvious reasons, probably like their own smell. My dog was rolling in a dead bird in the backyard just a couple of days ago, and he seemed pretty happy. I haven't given him a bath yet because, frankly, I was reading your book, and you said, don't do it.
It's good of you. Yeah, they don't need to be perfumed for their sake. I mean, their smell is giving information to other dogs, hence this constant investigation with the nose of each other. Even after dogs meet and smell each other, they continue to smell each other. So there's continuous information and time about the other individual. And to cover that up, to blanket it with something which is preferable to us, is to rob them of a little bit of their identity temporarily, it seems to me.
Do you mean that word, identity?
Yeah. Their personal identity, you know, who is this dog who is approaching me? You know, it's writ in my smells.
So when you take your dog for a walk, I mean, we have our own experience of what it's like to walk our dog, but I'm wondering from their experience, what is a walk for them?
Well, it's an interesting question. My guess is that it's a number of things. One, it's an opportunity. It's a very exciting opportunity to smell the world. So they spend most of the day in a relatively cloistered olfactory environment. Smells are moving through a room in the day, but there are not a lot of new smells coming in unless the windows are wide open. So going outside is seeing a great vista of smells. It's a social opportunity, And it's a social opportunity with you. You have a chance to interact with your dog, and they're very alert to your responses to them in that time, sometimes more alert than at home. And it's a social opportunity to see who has been out,
right,
not just the dogs who were there and they're going to encounter, but who has left marks, you know, repeatedly down the street, and smell what's up ahead of them, smell who is coming. So I think it's a pretty exciting time for them.
Well, and I have a dog, and I'm sure anyone has. There are times it seems like they are these little smell detectives. You know, it's like a blade of grass, and he's just
absolutely
sniffing it, you know, every nook and cranny of that blade of grass.
Yeah, and I don't think I can even quite imagine how rich that the information from that blade of grass might be. But something that has touched it, that has stepped on it, something, a molecule from someone's sandwich earlier in the day that has landed there, that information, mm-hmm, in theory, can be detected by their nose, by those 300 million receptors. So it's information to them. It's not just an ordinary blade of grass.
And just to add to this, you also say that dogs can smell time or sort of tell time through smell, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I think this is part of what I tried to do, was use the science to then, as I say, evoke what the experience of dogs might be like. And if your primary sense is smell, you realize some interesting things about smell. Well, one, smell exists in time. That is, an odor is going to be more concentrated if it's just applied to a surface than if it was applied 10 minutes before or an hour before or a day before. And so dogs can detect that difference. This is how tracking dogs tell the difference, tell which way somebody's run away. They know the difference between the right foot, which went down half a second before the left foot. So they know, based on the difference in concentrations of odor, which direction the person has fled. Well, so that essentially means that they're detecting something which is a little further back in time and something which happened more recently. That's as though they're seeing a wider window of the present time than we are, it seems to me, when they smell something.
We're almost up in a break here, but do dogs smell disgust? I mean, the kind of thing that would make them do what humans do, which is go, ugh.
There do seem to be some smells they don't prefer, absolutely. You know, for instance, they'll walk around their own excreta. They don't seem to be interested in investigating that. But it much more for us do we smell in disgust and pleasure. I think for them, smell is just more information.
That's Alexandra Horowitz, our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about dogs, something that she's spent a lot of time as a cognitive psychologist doing research and making observations. And she's got a new book. It's called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. We've been focusing on the dog's nose and what they smell. After this very short break, we'll talk about some of the other senses of dogs and also talk about relationships, anthropomorphizing dogs, and take your call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Germantown Academy in Fort Washington supports WHYY. GA is committed to being a place where children can discover who they really are and what they can become. Offering a pre-K through 12 co-ed curriculum, their faculty helps students discover their inner artist, athlete, and academic. Founded in 1759, Germantown Academy celebrates its 250th year. An open house will take place Thursday, October 8th at 8:30 a.m. Details at germantownacademy.net.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY at 11:20. Ahead at noon on Here and Now, a profile of CNN's legendary war camerawoman, Margaret Moth. Today's forecast, turning windy, sunny skies this afternoon, high 66 degrees. Clear overnight, still windy, low dropping back to 50. Tomorrow, plenty of sunshine, Thursday's high 69. Friday, partly cloudy, high 72 degrees, and then the chance of rain on Saturday, cooler, high in the mid-60s.
Supporting WHYY, the Delaware Theater Company, opening its 31st season with the East Coast premiere of Fire on the Bayou, October 14th through November 1st. Told through the eyes of Hurricane Katrina survivors, Fire on the Bayou celebrates the music and the spirit that defines Louisiana. Written and directed by native New Orleanian Kevin Ramsey, creator and director of Sam Cooke, Forever Mr. Soul. Tickets at 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Alexandra Horowitz. She's a cognitive scientist, assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College at Columbia University, and she's got a new book called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. And we got a full bank of calls here. Surprise, surprise. People want to talk about dogs. Let me just move on with you, Alexandra, from the nose to the eyes. We'll get to hearing, and then we'll get to our callers. You say dogs' eyes are very structurally very different from humans' eyes. Describe how they work.
Well, there is a way in which they're similar, but they're organized so that they don't see terribly well, at least not most breeds, right in front of them. And they're much more attuned to quick motion, hence their ability to see something running out of the bushes, say. But you'll often notice that a dog won't see something right in front of it. You know, you put a toy right by the dog's paws, and the dog looks at you with puzzlement, not able to find the toy. That's because they just don't have the same number of retinal cells right in the middle of their eyes as we do, so that we can focus on the book that's put right in front of us. There's also some interesting research out of Australia showing that the size of a dog's nose is an indicator of the distribution of cells on their eyes. And in particular, long-nosed dogs, like retrievers, seem to have a band of cells across the middle of their eyes, sort of across the horizon, and that allows them to see things better bouncing on the horizon, say a rabbit running or a ball being tossed. And then the short-nosed dogs, like a pug, for instance, do have more cells right in the middle of their eye, and so they don't see those bouncing things as well, but they're really good at staring at your face and look at you agreeably when they sit on your lap.
In fact, you say that one thing that makes a dog different from a wolf is that dogs make eye contact.
Yeah, in many species, including wolves, eye contact is a threat. So wolves won't stare at each other continuously, locking gaze, unless one means to give a threat to the other, and usually an eye contact will result in aggression. So it's quite a profound difference for the dog to stare at our faces, and in any other context, that would be viewed as a threat by us or by them.
So they want to know what we're doing, what are they looking for, do you think?
Well, I think that what it turns out they're able to see by looking at our face is what our attention is, whether our attention is on them, if we're indicating, say, where we're going with our gaze, or maybe they can get information from us, like where we put that toy out of their reach, or where we've hidden the food. So the side effect of their bothering to look at our faces, and it might have initially been an accidental trait that early dogs had, is that they're able to get information from our faces. And, of course, that's appealing to us because that's how we deal with each other.
You also say, and this is really, I think, counter to a prevailing theory, I don't know how popular it still is, that when humans live with dogs, that dogs look to that human being as the pack leader, the kind of alpha dog. You really challenge that. How do you see the relationship between dogs and humans then?
I do challenge that, and this comes entirely from recent, very good research looking at wild wolf behavior. These researchers say that wild wolves though they live in a pack, their life is not one fueled by fighting to get to the top of the hierarchy. Instead, packs are usually almost all related individuals, so a mated pair, a male and female, and then generations of their offspring. So in some way, that mated pair, the parents, are the alpha pair, but no one else is competing with them to be at the top. So in other words, while human parents, might in some ways be alphas over their children,
right,
it doesn't mean that the children are trying to compete with the parents. So it doesn't make sense to use that analogy when trying to understand domestic dog behavior.
So when you look at dogs and humans together, is it a couple?
Right. I think it's a family. I think
it's
family.
A family
is a good way, or I sort of describe in the book as a gang, like a benign gang. We're all sort of friends. We don't even have to be in a position of parent and child, but either of those analogies work better.
There is that impulse. I mean, think anyone that has a dog to anthropomorphize the dog. Do you do that? Have you done that with the dogs in your life?
Oh, of course. Yes, I have. And I still do, despite the fact that as a scientist, I have an inbuilt caution against attributing human characteristics to a non-human animal. I think it's a natural thing to do, and it seems like we've been doing it so long as a species that there must be something correct in it. But as a scientist, I'm interested in trying to understand the dog from the dog's vantage, right. So I have to try to get rid of those anthropomorphisms.
But as you say, it's a tough thing to do sometimes.
Absolutely. It takes a conscious effort, but I think it's rewarding because when you stop seeing the dog as a little furry human and instead see the dog as its own creature, you start to better appreciate what they're capable of and what they're not capable of.
I wrestle whether dogs love us or they're little furry psychopaths and they're just using us.
Well, it might be a little of both, right?
But we, you know, this gaze that you talk about, I mean, we associate that with love, right? Our dog loves us, and we come home, and they're so happy to see us.
That's true, but I do think affection is part of the relationship that we have with dogs. And now, how the dog would define that? Well, we have to admit it would be different than how we define it for the dog. My love for my pooch is different than his love for me. In fundamental ways, but I don't doubt that he loves me, and there's a huge amount of his behavior which indicates that he does. I mean, he wants to affiliate with me, always comes back to me. Am I also a food source for him? Yes, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't have affection.
Well, let's talk about kisses, because you say some pretty interesting things about dog kisses in your book.
Yeah, this is a nice case where our anthropomorphisms are wildly mislead us. Often people are greeted when they come in the door by slobbery licks on the face, if they indulge that, and it feels like affection. So that's one of the cases where it looks like love. But if we look at wolf behavior, we get a really good idea that the kiss might be something different. When a hunting wolf returns to his or her pack, all the other wolves mob his face and lick around his mouth, and what they're doing is not only greeting him back, but also requesting that he regurgitate a little of that meat that he just hunted. And he often does, and this is how they share some of their bounty. So it might be that what the dog is doing when we come in the door is requesting a little bit of the sandwich, which we had when we were out. And if we gave him a little bit of that sandwich, I don't think he would be at all disappointed. Surprised, maybe, but not disappointed.
You have forever changed my notion of dog kisses. Just want you to know that.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Let me throw one more sense in, and then we will get to our callers. And you also write about dog hearing. And, of course, you know, we know a little bit about, at least as outsiders, about how they hear the world. But help us understand what you know about how dogs hear the world.
Sure. They have actually, in some ways, a similar hearing range to ours, but they can hear much higher frequencies. So that explains the success of the inaudible dog whistle being picked up by dogs. This does mean, too, that they can hear types of sounds that we might not even think make sounds, are sounds at all. There are sounds in a typical alarm clock or in fluorescent bulbs, which might be very annoying to a dog because of the constant little hum to them, which we never hear. What they can't do with hearing, which we actually do a little better, is use sound to localize the source of the sound. So they'll hear something and they'll get alert. You'll hear, you know, if you call your dog when you're out and off-leash, have them off-leash in an open space, you might notice that they'll recognize that their name is being called. They'll perk their ears, but they might not run immediately to you. In fact, they might run the opposite direction. They need smell or sight to accompany hearing before they can really identify where the source of the sound is.
I've noticed a lot of people talk to their dogs the way they talk to their children, with kind of higher, more sort of squeaky voices. Is that helpful to a dog?
It really is. It helps them to distinguish that sound from all the other yammering that's going on around them. We're constantly talking around them. Most of it is not directed to them. So by using a higher pitched voice, kind of what's called motherese or baby talk, although some people might think it's silly, it actually is helpful in getting the dog's attention.
And that's Alexandra Horowitz, our guest today on Radio Times. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College at Columbia University, and she's got a new book we're talking about called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. And it's based on current research and her observations about what dogs do and how they interact with humans and, frankly, how they view the world. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Dan from Marion Station to join our conversation. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I am somebody who trains sporting dogs primarily for hunting. And one of the things that we note when we're training such dogs, Brittany Spaniels, German Short-Haired Pointers, and so on, are that they can actually discriminate through their smell, we believe, between different types of game. That is to say, they behave differently when they're working with quail or pheasants, or the difference between woodcock and grouse. They seem to actually detect the nuances of the smell of the different animal, of the different birds. I'm told by people who train herding dogs, and I do not have that experience, but I'm told by those people that very well-trained herding dogs can do the same thing. That is to say, they will behave differently depending upon the type of animal they're herding, whether it's a herd of sheep or a herd of cattle or what have you. Is that what your guest has observed?
Well, let's find out, Dana. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Alexandra, go ahead.
Yeah, I have much less experience working with or knowing hunting animals than you. But I would say that not only can they distinguish between these birds by smell, but they also will notice different behavioral differences in the birds. They're really acute observers as well as being good smellers. So the difference between a quail and a pheasant taking off, while it might be trivial to us, is actually quite a big difference to a dog. And they could detect difference in the timing as well as slight differences in the body and breadth of the wingspan of the birds. So these things, which in some way that we might not be able to articulate, help us distinguish the birds, also help the animals distinguish the birds. And it's not at all surprising to me that dogs can do this. They might not be characterizing them as different birds, but they come to know the different smell and sight of them and can respond accordingly.
Dan, thanks for the call. Let me get Tucker from Washington, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Tucker. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm also an animal trainer. I do movie and television work. And I get a lot of questions on the set. And one that I have answered, and I'm just trying to check and see if your guest agrees with me, is that when dogs stick their nose out of a car window, they're adding, it's basically kind of like if we stuck our nose out the car window, it would be like a still photograph, and they see Incinerama when they stick their nose out the window.
And so,
all that extra sensory stuff going by, and it just must be a whole different dimension to their thinking.
You agree, Alexandra?
I'd say that what it's like for them, sticking the nose out the window, is like opening the window on a terrific visual landscape. So there's a large amount of information, and not only that, but it's moving. So it's like watching a fabulous moving picture. Smells are not only present, but they're smelling what's up ahead or what's some smell that's being whipped around into the car. Yeah, so it's like a movie experience for them. And there must also be a tactile sensation associated with this, which is, I think, not at all unpleasant to them.
High-def movie, I would think. Just all that information. Tucker, thanks for the call. Let me see what Don from Washington's Crossing has to say. Hi, Don. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a veterinarian, and I find the show fascinating.
Thanks.
And I find it interesting how perceptive animals are to, I describe it to clients all the time that if you were reading body language all day long, think how good you'd be at it and how, you know, how they sense our emotions and, you know, countless stories and situations. And I find it fascinating how commonly people misinterpret so many of what their animals, well, to me it becomes more clear what they're saying, but with experience, but how they, I think they anthropomorphize, as you said, often, and they're so commonly getting into trouble because they are misreading their animal signs. And I find it extremely common that that happens. And how they pick up on visual and smells. I see it every day, and it's amazing just how intuitive they are. Obviously, I want to read your book. I think it's something.
Well, you know what, Dawn, let me just take your point, because I think your phone is breaking up, and let me just toss this back to you, Alexander.
Sure.
Horowitz. I mean, it almost sounds like dogs know us better than we know them.
In some ways, I think of them as anthropologists of human behavior, because they sit there and eavesdrop on us most of the day. Now imagine if you had somebody else across the room sitting and watching you as you work at the computer, or you work at your veterinary hospital, and observing what behaviors come before other behaviors, and seeing what the indication is that they're about to give you a treat or that they're about to leave the room, etc. I mean, they become extremely good observers of us, but because we seem to already come to ownership of dogs, knowing what dogs are all about and feeling like dogs act in X, Y, and Z ways, sometimes we don't look at what they're actually doing as well as we could.
You ran a very interesting experiment about whether dogs feel guilt or not if they, quote-unquote, misbehave, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. It was really a test of the guilty look. So it's very hard to know whether dogs actually experience guilt, but I wanted to test the next best thing, which was that this guilty look we all recognize, where a dog puts his ears back and ducks his head and his tail wags between his legs and maybe slinks away, whether that look indicated that the dog was actually feeling guilt. So I set up an experiment with using dogs and their owners in their homes, where I asked the owners to give the dogs a bit of a treat, or at least put it right in front of them, and forbid them from eating it. Right. The dogs were all able to do that. Then the owners left the room. When the owner was gone, I either took the treat from the dog, in other words, ensuring that he would not eat the treat, or I gave it to the dog, ensuring his disobedience of the owner's request. And when the owner returned, I asked them to either gently scold their dog. They usually did this with just a no, however they ordinarily scolded their dog, if the dog had been disobedient, and just greet the dog as normal if the dog had been obedient. But the key was that I occasionally misled the owners. So when the dog had actually not eaten the treat, because I had taken it away, the owners came in and I said, oh, he ate the treat. And so they scolded the dog. And sometimes when the dog had eaten the treat, I said, oh, he was obedient. And so they just greeted the dog. So I got an opportunity to see then, looking at the videotape of this experiment later on, when did they show the most of that guilty look? And it turned out they didn't show any more of the guilty look when they actually had directly disobeyed and eaten the treat that the owner had told them not to, than when they had obeyed. They showed the most guilty look when they were scolded, regardless of whether they had been disobedient.
You know, hold on to that thought, because I want to pick up on
sure.
that after this very short break. And that's Alexandra Horowitz. We're talking about dogs, something she knows quite a bit about. She's written a book called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be talking about dogs and whether they feel guilt or not after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, under the baton of Chief Conductor Charles Dutoit, performing Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique October 8th through 10th at the Kimmel Center. Maestro Dutoit is joined with pianist Yuzha Wang in a performance of Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 2, and the concert opens with Barber's Adagio for Strings. Tickets for the Philadelphia Orchestra are available at 215-893-1999 or philorc.org.
It's 11:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. What's in Kenya's future? This afternoon at 1 on Tell Me More, Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai explores what's ahead for that troubled country. Today's forecast, sunshine this afternoon, windy, a high of 66 degrees. Clear overnight, low falling back to 50. Tomorrow, plenty of sunshine, Thursday's high 69. Friday, partly cloudy, up to 72 degrees. Showers possible Saturday, high 66.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. The University of the Sciences has created an official Twitter account. The service provides real-time connections and discourse on the university's news, events, and happenings on campus. Twitter also enables the university to interact with prospective and current students. Twitter users can connect at usp.edu/Twitter to get updates on the latest USP news. usp.edu/Twitter.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoyne talking about dogs with Alexandra Horowitz. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College at Columbia University. And we've got a full bank of calls here. But let's finish this story about the test you ran about whether dogs feel guilt or not. So what did you learn?
What the test indicated was that that guilty look wasn't prompted by the dogs actually doing something for which they should feel guilty. Instead, it seemed to be prompted by the owner's scolding behavior. So the look is a little bit more of a submissive look than it is an I know that I did something that I shouldn't have done, which isn't to say they don't feel guilt.
Right.
What it's more a critique of is our anthropomorphism, that we see guilt in this look. That looks like if they feel guilt, they're showing it some other way, and maybe we haven't really picked up on it yet.
But what you observed was dogs responding to their owner's tone. It was the tone of their voice that made them have this quote-unquote guilty look on their face.
Right, right, or their posture, or some other, maybe even a stress hormone that they were picking up on, and presumably because they've been in that context with this particular person before, where they've done something, and the response by the owner has been negative, and so they're putting on this look in order to try to avoid any punishment or anger.
And when someone hits a dog, do you know what the dog's experience of that is?
I think it's a classic experience of a negative stimulus. Punishment can be successful in getting a dog to stop doing something, but mostly it is they'll associate it with the person who does the punishing, the person who does the hitting. So they'll learn to be fearful and avoidant of that person.
Let me get Sarah from Bluebell to join our conversation. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I'm actually a doggy daycare owner, and I'm finding the talking about sniffing and their sense of smell absolutely relevant to what we do.
Sure.
One funny story we have is we actually hang leashes by the front gate when the dogs come in, and we actually have dogs that come in and will sniff all the leashes to see who's here that day.
That's terrific.
That's great.
Yeah. We also have dogs that we know alert to their owners coming about 5 to 10 minutes before the owner actually gets here.
What do they do? I'm curious.
Well, while they're in the play yard, they actually start pacing. Some of them kind of run around in circles. Some of them kind of whine and bark a little bit. We have a beagle that howls quite a bit. So we've always kind of had this internal debate about whether they smell them or hear them.
What do you think, Alexander?
It's actually a question that's been debated for a long time, and there is at least one researcher who thinks that they have a kind of extrasensory capacity, which I would take to mean they just have some capacity we don't know about yet. Mm-hmm. But it looks like most of the time, and there are always situations that differ, but most of the time there are two things that could account for that behavior. One is the habitual nature of it. So if I'm always coming at approximately 5 p.m. after work to pick up my dog, then my dog will be able to anticipate that. It's not that they're telling time, but it's that they're very good at noticing the passage of time and become accustomed to a certain length of time passing. And if they are close enough, if the car or whatever other approaching sign is close enough, they absolutely can smell it if the wind is in the right direction. But I'd say just being a creatures of habit, if you arrive habitually, they'll start to anticipate your arrival habitually.
Sarah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's get Janice from Ewing, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Janice. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Janice Conklin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a positive reinforcement dog trainer, and I work in the Bucks County area, and I would love to applaud Alexandra Horowitz for focusing on the skills and talents of dogs instead of outmoded notions about dominance theory. Woohoo! When I heard you give your answer before, I let out a yip. It's people take the strangest information about dogs as though it were gospel, and boy, does that ever cause big problems for both of them. So it's so wonderful to be able to have research on this stuff, so thank you. And I have one more thing, if you have a half second.
Yeah, go ahead, Janice.
Did the name of your book come from the Groucho Marx quote?
It does. Very astute, yes. For those of you who don't know it, it's Outside of a Dog, a Book is Man's Best Friend. Inside of a Dog, it's Too Dark to Read.
Brilliant.
So I look forward
to reading your book.
Thanks, Janice.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well. Just looks like one open line at 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious, Alexandra, because you have a new baby, as you said. Do you see some parallels between, you know, the dogs you've lived with or the puppies you lived with and your new baby?
Well, my observations have been less scientific than usual.
I can only imagine, yes.
But it is the case, which is interesting, is that dogs develop much more quickly. I've never actually owned a puppy this young. You know, they should really still be with their mother this young. But the developmental course of dogs is so much more rapid. So actually, my dog at this age would have been doing slightly more sophisticated behaviors than my baby is doing. You know, of course, my baby will far surpass the dog pretty quickly, but the rate of development of movement abilities, of attention to eyes, is slower. But what I have noticed is the same is my sort of anthropomorphism of both of them. I mean, it should be appropriate to anthropomorphize other humans.
Right.
But it's clear that we attribute a lot to infants, which isn't actually part of their skill set yet, too.
How much do you think, and perhaps there's no answer to this question, but are we learning more and more about what dogs can actually learn to do?
Yeah, and I think one of the nice things about the cognition research with dogs that has really been on the rise in the last 10 years is that we see occasional examples of extraordinary sounding dogs. There's a dog like Rico, studied by some German researchers, who could identify 250 different toy names and distinguish each one, so that asked to retrieve a specific name, that he could pick it out of a huge pile of toys. Well, maybe not every dog can do this, but with a little training, I think most dogs can do it. It really is just a matter of focusing our interaction with the dog on the things that bring out their abilities.
Let me get Kathy from Harleysville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have an interesting little story and a question. My son last year was in fourth grade, and he did a science fair project. And his project was to find out whether or not dogs have a paw preference. Just as we're left-handed or right-handed, he wanted to know if the dogs preferred to use their left or their right paw. So I don't know how scientific or you know, how precise this study was. About 20 dogs. We had people in the neighborhood and friends test their dogs with a treat or however they could get them to use their paw. And out of the 15 or 20 dogs, it seemed like the left paw was preferred by the dogs in this particular group. So my question is, can dogs actually have a paw preference?
Great. Well, as it happens, your son was, you know, reproducing a couple of experiments that have been done studying exactly that. And it looks like dogs definitely have a handedness or a pawedness, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And different research groups have found different findings. Some say males have left pawedness, and some say females have left pawedness. So doesn't seem that the species as a whole has one preference over the other, but it's definitely the case that individual dogs prefer one side or the other side, and that's, I think, really revealing and kind of great research that your son is doing, because it explains a lot of their behaviors. For instance, we always are asked to heel our dogs on our left sides. So that's usually how it's trained. Well, some dogs might prefer to be on the other side, and they're reluctance to always be shunted over to the left might not be their stubbornness, but it might be that they really prefer to deal with the world on the other side of the human.
And do you think that's how you'd know if your dog was reluctant to be on that side?
You could certainly try doing them on the other side and seeing if that settled them a little bit.
Kathy, I hope your son got an A on that project, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. We've got Sandy now from, looks like, Roxborough joining us. Hi, Sandy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My beagle, Mandela, whenever I play the piano, no matter where he is in the house, he comes running and gets under the piano and starts howling.
And what are you playing on that piano?
No matter what I play, and it's not just me, because, you know, like other people have come over who actually, you know, train musicians, and he just comes running and gets under the piano and starts howling. And I don't know, you know, is he singing along? Does he hate it? I can't figure out what it is.
Well, let's find out and see what Alexandra Horowitz thinks. What do you think, Alexandra?
Well, you probably would actually know better than I, knowing the history of your dog's behavior, but it is the case that howling started out, at least we see in wolves, as a, what we would call affiliative behavior. So one wolf howls and others join, and it seems to be a way of indicating to each other that they're all together, that they're in a group together. So it's some sort of sense of community. And maybe what you're doing in playing the piano, not to put down your piano playing ability, but is somewhat howl-like to him. Whether he hates it or not, I would say that if he comes to the piano and sits near it, that's a good sign that he doesn't hate it.
Sandy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And what about wagging their tail? What is that about? Or what's the evolution of that, do you think?
Well, a tail is a great indicator of how you're feeling. And so dogs and wolves use it pretty provocatively. We all know that a real loose, jangly, wagging tail indicates something happy. But a really low wagging tail also is part of the body posture of being submissive or trying to not look larger than they are in order to not be a threat to another animal. So a low wagging tail means something else. And a really kind of metronome-like wagging tail is often part of a very erect posture that a dog will put on when he wants to show that he's a dominant dog.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think dogs get lonely? And I'm thinking about all the dogs that spend time at home while they're while their mother and father are at work.
Yeah, well,
but
that's
here we
fine,
go.
Yeah. I do think they get lonely and bored. Yes, it behooves us as the ones who leave them alone to try to give them something to do or give them as much companionship as we can. They certainly sleep a lot, but they'll sleep way more than they need to if they have nothing to do and no one to interact with.
So toys or those balls that have things inside, something like that to keep them occupied?
Certainly that does seem to be sophisticated enough to keep them occupied for a long time. With my dog, I used to put little tiny treats out around the house, sort of a bit of a treasure hunt for her. And she would go and find them in the course of being alone by herself during the day. If you have the opportunity to have your dog with another dog, that's terrific too, because that's just the stimulation of another social creature.
Do they watch TV?
Well, it's changed a little with the digital TV, but it used to be the case that they couldn't actually see the TV as well as we thought, or at least they weren't seeing what we thought they were seeing. And this is because their eyes have, this is another difference in their eyes and our eyes, a different flicker fusion rate, which is the number of little snapshots of the world that they take in a second. We take about 60 snapshots of the world, our eyes do, and we see that as smooth motion. Mm-hmm. So television sends out 60 snapshots in a second, and we perceive it as smooth motion. But dogs see a little bit more than we do. They see 70 or 80 snapshots in a second. So to them, TV, at least the old analog TV, would be like one of those old film reels that slowed down in the projector with big stills followed by white-black bands between the stills.
But digital TV looks more like what
digital
we see?
Digital TV should look more like what we see, but they probably don't translate it as well into three dimensions as we naturally do. So it's images, it's moving, they might even be able to identify form, but of course it's not. It doesn't have any smell interest to them, so it's not as terribly interesting as it is to us. They probably won't become couch potatoes with the same alacrity as we do.
Exactly. Let me get Marushta from Bridgeton, Pennsylvania, to join us. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes, hi. Wonderful program. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wonder whether dogs sense a fear within a person toward them. Is there some...
No, that's actually a very interesting question. And what do you think? Do you think dogs smell fear?
It's absolutely possible that they can detect a hormone that we emit when we feel fearful, a stress hormone. We know, in fact, that dogs can detect the stress hormone cortisol, which we emit through our pores, and which we don't notice in each other. But dogs have the ability to detect, and that combined with the posture of a fearful person, which is very different and distinctive from one who feels content or not at all anxious, indicates that, yeah, I think a dog can in fact, as the old adage goes, smell your fear. That doesn't mean that they're going to respond with aggression, but that if you're worried about a dog you don't know, it isn't going to help you to show your anxiousness.
And we're almost out of time here. Are you going to continue your research on dogs?
Absolutely. It's really not, dogs have not been researched as much as we think they have. We don't really know as much about them as we think we do. So I think there's lots still to examine. And plus, I'd like interacting with all the dogs.
Who wouldn't want to interact with all
Absolutely.
Those dogs? Well, Alexandra Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And Alexandra Horowitz is an assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College, and that's at Columbia University. She's a cognitive scientist, and she has spent a lot of time researching animals and specifically dogs. And we've been talking about her new book. It's called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. And we appreciate your phone calls to Radio Times. Also, you can go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email, find out more about the program, and tell us what you think of Radio Times. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of the program. Patty Leswing and Dennis Devine are the producers of Radio Times. And Susan Greenbaum is the senior producer of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Walking bird dog.